Hello. Good afternoon. This is Kathy Connor of Kathy's Corner, and I haven't been here for a while. In fact, I have done a few shows, and I've sent them in on some other methodology, but today I'm actually at the station, so it's the first time in many, many months, so welcome back to me. So good afternoon. You're listening to Kathy's Corner on WPKN. We're 89.5 FM, and we're streaming online at the moment at WPKN.org. It's always streaming online. And my shows are also podcast. They can be found at SoundCloud, WPKN Community Radio, Kathy's Corner. So if you're listening for the first time, I've had a show for about 9 years, maybe even coming up on 10. I actually can't even remember when I started, but I've had a monthly show on PKN as part of a series where experts share their knowledge with you, the listener. So these days, my show is on a little less often. Instead of the third Wednesday of the month, I'm now on the fifth Wednesday of the month, so that's a little less. My expertise is the field of consciousness and how the development of inner life supports success in outer life, day-to-day active life. And we all have consciousness, so that's a good topic to talk about. Consciousness is awareness. It's pure intelligence. Consciousness isn't something that you find. It already exists. It's something to expand. It's something that can be refined. Consciousness is fundamental to life. Everything we do, everything we see and experience, that's an impulse of awareness, of consciousness. So I usually mention at the start of every show, just to give everyone a perspective, that we know from personal experience that we have three states of consciousness, different values of consciousness. There's waking, dreaming, and sleeping. but for many of us, there's an impulse to search for more, like best waking, best dreaming, best sleeping. But is there more than that even? And yes, there are more refined or higher states of awareness. And they are also scientifically verified, just like the other three are, and experientially verified states of consciousness. So on this show, I talk a lot about the fourth state of consciousness, because that is actually the gateway to a balanced physiology, to one's fuller potential, a fully alert consciousness. This fourth state is the experience that everyone has when they do the TM practice every day, twice a day, 20 minutes. It's also an experience you can have other times. You could call it the zone or a runner's high or an incredible moment. But to have it consistently is really the key now. And we refer to this experience as restful alertness or transcendental consciousness. And it identifies that the mind is alert, clear, orderly. The body is deeply rested. So it's always been my pleasure, especially today, because it's been a while since I've actually been at the station, that I can share with you over 45 years of knowledge and experience in this field of consciousness, and particularly knowledge how to unfold more of its value from within the mind for your best self. My day job, I'm a director of the Transcendental Meditation Program for Fairfield County, Connecticut. TM is a specific form of meditation that regularly and systematically provides the experience of the inner value of life, direct contact with those finer fields of the mind we've been talking about, in order to unfold the qualities of a higher state of consciousness. So it's a procedure to unfold consciousness. It's not so different than, say, clearing the fog from the mirror or clouds moving across the sun in order to bring in more light. And if you've heard the show before, you know I always say that. So in every show, I like to make a connection to a particular topic or something that's going on at the time. And I like to relate consciousness. I like to relate the value of understanding and, more importantly, unfolding more of our potential and consciousness to that topic. So I was thinking, you know, my next show, last show was July, so I thought, well, the next show is September. And what do you think of when you think of September? Well, one of the first things that comes to mind for many of us is school starting. And so even though this is the last day of September, I'm still thinking about school because we keep seeing on the news things that are happening in our schools. So today we want to talk about our school-age children and particularly how they're managing and this unusual school year particularly. So to address how our children can be their best selves, I am very happy to speak with an expert, Dr. William Stixrud. Dr. Stixrud is a clinical neuropsychologist and founder of the Stixrud Group. He's a member of the adjunct faculty of the Children's National Medical Center, and he is an assistant professor of psychiatry and pediatrics at the George Washington University School of Medicine. Dr. Stixrud is also a frequent lecturer on topics related to neuropsychological assessment, brain development, motivation, meditation, and the effects of stress, sleep deprivation, and technology overload on the brain. His work has been featured in publications such as the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Times of London, the Wall Street Journal, U.S. News and World Report, Time Magazine, Scientific American, Business Week, Barron's, and New York Magazine, very reputable journals. Dr. Stixrud is the co-author of the book, The Self-Driven Child, The Science and Sense of Giving Your Kids More Control Over Their Lives. And guess what else? He's a rock and roll musician who plays in the band Close Enough. And so Dr. Stixrud, we're going to call him Bill if you don't mind, he is the perfect combination for this particular radio station, intellect and music. We love that. So welcome, Bill, to the show.
Hi, Kathy.
How are you?
I'm wonderful. How are you?
I am also wonderful. I'm really happy to be back at the station, and I'm happy to be talking to you. I've been looking forward to this for a while. I wanted to begin, if you don't mind, with your book, because I read it and I loved it, and I thought, let's share this information with the listeners. So can you start with maybe even explaining to us what the title is all about and a premise of the book?
Sure. So the book is called The Self-Driven Child, and the subtitle is The Science and Sense of Giving Kids More Control Over Their Lives. And I wrote it with my friend Ned Johnson, and Ned is the kind of premier test prep guy in the greater D.C. area, for SAT, ACT kind of stuff. He's brilliant at getting kids' test scores up by helping them put things in perspective and stay calm when they're working. And he's also, like, I've been practicing GM for 47 years. He's been doing GM for 10, I think. But we started lecturing together some years ago. I'd been studying the effects of stress in the brain and stress on kids' development. So we started lecturing quite a bit about stress. And we lectured a lot about motivation, because some of the kids that Ned sees are just absurdly, obsessively driven. Mm. And they sacrifice their health, their well-being, their family to get into elite colleges. And a lot of the kids that I see who have learning disabilities or ADHD or really high anxiety, they figure, what's the point of trying? I'm never going to be a top student. And so we focused on, as we lectured, we decided to write a book. We were thinking, what's the best way to organize the stuff that we think is really important? And at one point, we said, it's really this sense of control. It's about a sense of control. And a sense of control doesn't mean that a kid gets to control everything, gets to be the boss, or he's supposed to control everything. It just means that subjective sense of agency or autonomy, which is good for everything. And it also means having a brain state that supports that, which is basically in which the prefrontal cortex, the most recently evolved part of the brain, that can think rationally, can put things in perspective, regulates the rest of the brain, including the amygdala, the very primitive part of the brain that senses and reacts to threat. So the goal of our book is to help parents understand the importance of supporting this autonomy, this sense of agency, and also helping kids stay in a brain state where they're, for the most part, they're in their right mind, where they're focused and they're engaged and they're motivated, but they aren't highly stressed and they aren't exhausted. Mm-hmm. So So that's the basic focus. The sense of control is good for everything. And some of the early studies on TM showed that actually even though TM doesn't work if you try to control it, you know, you can't right. force your mind to block your thoughts. But what happens is you spontaneously have a higher sense of kind of, this is my life and I can guide my life right. and I'm not helpless, I'm not hopeless, I'm not passive, I'm not overwhelmed.
Yeah, I this is so important. And I think especially now, it's very important to understand these principles. Because when I think about how we tend to guide our children, we tend to push them in a particular direction, maybe something that we want them to do. And right in the beginning of the book, you say, it's in the introduction even, that our role is to teach our children to think and act independently so that they will have the judgment to succeed in school and life. And I'm pretty sure that's what every parent wants to do, but it's how they're doing it. And just reading that book that you and Ned wrote together, it just felt like we have to change our point of view on how we're educating our children, even in the home and even in the schools, because there was a few things that came up in the book that I completely related to, which I'm sure most people would. You remember when you were a child and somebody is telling you what to do? Don't tell me what to do. I mean, that tends to be the first thing we want. Don't tell me what to do. I mean, I've had a bunch of siblings and I still say that to them. Don't tell me what to do.
Yeah.
And I think it's important that, tell us a little more about how important this principle is of, I was thinking of it as taking your foot off the gas. It doesn't mean that you're not giving them guidance, but it means you're not giving them these tight boundaries either.
Yeah. So part of it is that, you know, the older I get, the more humble I get about knowing what's in a kid's best interest, because ultimately, I don't know who the kid wants to be. And the more I think about it, the more I want to support the kid in figuring out who he wants to be, because I want him to have a life that he wants. I mean, a good definition of a successful life is having a life that you're happy with. And the challenge is, or certainly one of the challenges, so many young people today are miserable. They're fairly young. We're seeing this dramatic increase in suicide, even in school-age kids. And there's so much stress and anxiety and unhappiness and chemical use in young people that something's really wrong with this picture. And we know that having a sense of control, being that I got this, I can handle this, is hugely important for mental health. And we refer to this. There's a guy out in Colorado, at the University of Colorado, named Steve Mayer, who studies rats. And what he's demonstrated is that he has two the basic paradigm of his research is there's rat A and rat B, and they're these plexiglass cages, and their tail's outside the cage, and there's a little wheel inside the cage. So rat A, his tail gets shocked, and he turns the wheel as fast as he can. And when he's doing that, his prefrontal cortex activates, and it dampens down the stress response, and rat A goes into coping mode, because what happens is he learns that if he turns the wheel, the shock stops. Rat B, the tail gets shot, he turns the wheel, and nothing happens. The wheel doesn't work. And what happens is that rat A, who has that experience of, I can control stressful situations, becomes almost impossible to stress as an adult rat. Rat B becomes a nervous wreck, really easily stressed. And so from a mental health point of view, this healthy sense of control is really a powerful thing. Mayer said that a sense of control inoculates you from the harmful effects of stress. And you think about it, there's a gal in Montreal, a scientist in Montreal, who says that there's four things that make life stressful. Novelty, and she summarized it with the acronym NUTS. The idea of stress makes you nuts kind of idea.
Yeah, that's true.
And it's novelty, unpredictability, perceived threat, and a low sense of control. And it's that low sense of control that's the most stressful thing you can experience, because you can be in a new situation or unpredictable situation, even a threatening situation. But if you figure, I can handle this, or my dad will come and pick me up, or you know, that it's not so stressful. It's when you're in a situation where you feel overwhelmed, or you don't have no idea how to solve a problem, or you've got a sick kid, nobody knows what to do, there's nothing more stressful. So for mental health, and just think about it, from a mental health point of view, if you're anxious, your thinking is out of control. You can't stop it. You can't control it. And if you're depressed, you can't get yourself out of bed. You have no control.
Right.
So the sense of control is hugely important from a mental health point of view in kids. And we've got this big mental health crisis on our hands.
Yes.
And Ned and I see this as really one of the really important ways to help, to think about supporting the sense of control. Because so many kids feel, they either feel passive, kind of resigned, you know, I hate this life, but it sucks, but what am I going to do? Or they're just chronically anxious and overwhelmed.
Yeah.
And this is not a healthy way for kids to grow up. It's terrible for their brain.
Yeah.
And so we're motivated to turn this around.
Well, I really did enjoy the book, because one of the things you do in every chapter is you offer things for parents to do. It isn't that you're just giving information, which is valuable, and it hopefully for a lot of people it'll turn their tension around, instead of thinking that, oh, my kid's got to get into a particular school and it's got to be a particular thing, just to be a little easier about that stuff so that their nature can come out and that pressure that's going on them isn't so harsh. But you actually offer tools. You offer lots of things. At the end of every chapter, there's a page or so of things that parents can do for their children to encourage their brain to reduce stress or help them manage stress better. So it's very useful as well. Talking about stress, just to mention, two of the things I talk about a lot on this show, or they're somehow woven into the topic, are stress and the brain. And these are two things that that you are quite the expert on, and comes out very clearly in the book about how we can help our children. I mean, we can help ourselves too. That's a topic we can talk about later. But we're really looking at the children because their brains are still developing. And what I was thinking as I was reading this is these are our future leaders. And we don't want a whole generation of highly stressed, depressed people that are running our world, which we might have now. We don't want that.
Well, it's an incredibly good point, Kathy, and you know, if you look at the mental health problems in the most elite colleges, you know, where more than 50% of the kids at Yale seek mental health services, and they sleep 4 hours a night, and the most popular course in the history of Yale University by far is a course that Lori Santos started a few years ago. Just a course on happiness and the good life, and basically teaching kids to how to be, what it takes to be happy, who've been growing up with this idea that the most important outcome of your childhood and adolescence, maybe your whole life, is where you go to college. And and I used to refer to this as because this idea is very prevalent in the D.C. area where I live, and I used to refer to it as a kind of a mass psychosis, because it's so, the thinking is so out of touch with reality. And then actually it turns out there's a diagnosis in our DSM manual. It's called shared delusional disorder. And this idea that the most important outcome of your whole life is where you go to college is just not real. And it doesn't have anything to do with reality. And so what we would suggest is that the major goal is that kids focus on developing themselves so they have something useful to offer this world. And the most important outcome of adolescence is not where you go to college. It's having a healthy brain. Mm. And we know that being chronically tired and chronically stressed is bad for your brain.
Yes.
And so we think if we really shifted our perspective and said, what would we do if we really thought that healthy brains are the most important outcome? We do things a lot differently.
Oh,
we don't want kids to be bored. We still want to challenge kids. I mean, that the brain wants to be challenged. It's just that we have all this fear-based motivation.
Oh, yeah.
There's all this academic pressure. Kids staying way late at night doing homework. We change it.
Oh, definitely. And speaking of the brain, you do talk a lot about it in the book. Can you tell us, you say there are four major brain systems. Can you explain those? Because each one of them is very integral to the discussion today about how to manage stress and to get enough rest.
so the four brain systems we talk about in the brain, we talk about in the book, are number one, the prefrontal cortex, which we talk about in the book as the pilot. And some people refer to it as the conductor of the orchestra. It's the executive functioning part of the brain that can plan and organize and carry out anything that requires that's goal-directed. So it's the executive functioning part. It's the stress response. It's the brain systems involved in the stress response. And the amygdala is particularly important because the amygdala is a very primitive part of the brain that doesn't think. It just senses and reacts to the emotional context of your experience. But it's particularly it has a very heightened sensitivity to fear and anger, anything that could be threatening. So it's the prefrontal cortex, the amygdala. It's the motivational system of the brain, particularly with the neurotransmitter dopamine, which is hugely important for motivation. And then it's a more recently discovered default mode network. And the default mode network is a series of it's a connection, these interconnected systems in the brain that activate whenever you aren't focused on a task. So if you're in the old days, you're sitting at a bus stop and not reading anything. You think about yourself, or now if you're in a doctor's office and you don't read or you don't get out your phone and you just sit and think, you tend to reflect on yourself and you think about your life and your past and your future. And it turns out that this default mode network uses like 80% of the brain's energy. It's a big deal. And there's a lot of concern these days that all the mental health problems and a lot of physical health problems are marked in part by a default mode that doesn't turn off easily or doesn't turn on easily. Mm. That a lot of kids with ADHD they get stuck in that kind of daydreamy unfocused phase. People who are more obsessive or ruminative, they get stuck on focusing on a task and have trouble just kind of relaxing into that default mode. And so, particularly with kids being wired 24/7, have their headphones in all the time, or on a screen all the time, there's concern that they aren't having enough experience of that default mode and transitioning back and forth between focus and this rest, focus and that resting state.
Yeah, so that's important.
Those are the four. Yeah.
Well, you were talking about the default mode network. I've been hearing about that lately. It seems to be a fairly, not brand new, but something I wasn't familiar with until in recent years. And does it have something to do with creativity? Because that was where I seemed to have that idea.
Well, certainly. I mean, when you think about, we know that daydreaming or mind wandering is hugely related to creativity and to problem solving. And that's what happens when you're in the default mode, is you kind of your mind wanders where it goes, and typically you think about your past or your future or what's going on in your life, and this state of daydreaming or mind wandering or self reflection is hugely important for kids because it's crucial for the development of a coherent sense of identity, because you have to be able to think about yourself, in your life and reflect on it to really understand who am I, who do I want to be. Mm-hmm. And also, it's crucial for development of empathy, because the way empathy develops in part is that I see something mean to a friend, and I see the hurt on their face, so they start crying, and I learn from that, and I need to reflect on it.
Oh, wow.
So it's important for creativity, for problem solving. People are now calling it the genius lounge. You think about that so many discoveries are made when people are just waking up. They're kind of before they're falling asleep, when they're meditating, and at least transcendental meditation we know activates that default mode. And certainly I've been meditating for 47 years, and I still have the experience of having something a problem I'm not sure how to solve. And I'll meditate. I'm not thinking about the problem, but it just pops. It's a solution pops into my head constantly. So I think the creativity and the problem solving are huge.
Yeah.
And for young people, for children, the development of a sense of identity and that capacity for empathy, really important to have enough time kind of just going back and forth, just focus and unfocus.
Well, I think this is really important information because it's always about balance, and the brain wants to be balanced. And when you were talking about certain children, maybe the default mode network is not turning off, the same thing can happen to the amygdala. And that's unfortunate because then that person's in a more hypervigilant state when the amygdala doesn't shut down. It's supposed to be there when you need it. You know, going to run across the street because the bear's chasing you. But you're not going to analyze it at that point. But it shouldn't stay on. And one of the things you talk about also is how important it is for children to start to learn how to the stress response system, but adapting quickly to things rather than holding on to them forever.
Yeah, right. So certainly, I mean, one of the kind of emotional traits that people differ on is simply how fast do you recover? How fast do you recover from a stressful situation, which is kind of the definition of resilience, that being the ability to bounce back and let it go. And I think, you know, we're born with proclivities one way or the other, but certainly there's practices that we can teach kids that help with that ability to let things go. And to recover quickly. And as you said, Kathy, I mean, the part of the reason we don't want kids to be chronically stressed is that the amygdala, the more you're stressed, the amygdala gets bigger and more, it actually grows in size, gets more connected with the rest of the brain, and it gets more reactive, gets more, one of the great neuroscientists, it gets more hysterical in the way it responds to things. And so really healthy development, we don't want kids to be chronically tired and chronically stressed. And so what we want to do is we want to be focusing on how do we have this balance between rest and activity that allows kids to be focused and on their game and motivated and engaged most of the time, but also know how to relax and know how to turn their mind off and stop worrying and not reacting to threats.
Yeah, and I think that's where we'll begin to see more and more changes in even our systems of education to give kids a chance to have that time to sort of rebalance or regroup or rest, because oftentimes it's one class, next class, and then you go home with a whole pile of homework. And, you know, there's a lot of pressure on them, and it's not always their fault. It's not even the parents' fault in some cases, although the parents can exacerbate that by standing over them. Did you finish your homework? You know, and that seems, for me, I was thinking that sounds like what a lot of households are doing. So we're not aware of how we're affecting their brains because we're not thinking about that.
Well, it's true. And, you know, and it's happening all over the world. I mean, I just did, a week ago, I did a webinar in India. You know, that 110,000 people are listening to it, because they have this idea that the most important thing is your achievement, and we know that there's one of the best theories in psychology, the best supported theories in psychology. It's called self-determination theory. It's a theory of intrinsic motivation, that internal motivation, self-drive, which the self-driven child is about, that internal self-driven, this is my life, I want to develop my life. That's what the self-driven child is about. But it's a theory of intrinsic motivation, and it holds that to be intrinsically motivated, to have that kind of internal motivation, you have to have three needs be met. One is for a sense of relatedness or connection to your parents or your teachers, your coach, sense of competence. You know, you don't really work very hard at something if you feel you're terrible at it, and a sense of autonomy. And so what happens with kids all over the world now, there's so much focus on achievement, on the competence part, on the competence, that it really undermines our relatedness to our kids and undermines their sense of autonomy. And I think that's partly what we're trying to turn around here, is focusing more on staying connected with our kids. And if we're pressuring them, and we're constantly demanding of them, and constantly that they aren't doing good enough, but they need more, that it harms our relatedness with them, and it undermines their autonomy.
Well, this is a point that I bring up often on the show, because, and even in the beginning, I mentioned that there's two qualities of life. There's the external and there's the internal. The external we know well. We'll call that the active world. The world when we wake up in the morning, I got to get to school, I got to get to work. And that's there and that's fine. There's nothing wrong with it. But there is something more than that. And that's when we can develop more of our internal qualities, which is that equanimity, which is that balanced state, because that supports the success in the outer. And that's the point I was getting from your book. I thought it was very well woven together that, you know, there are these points we can do to help our children at the same time make sure we nourish their brains, not just the body, which is important, but we want to nourish the brain. So here are some tips for that. And I found in your book that there were two chapters at least that were particularly on how important it is for the kids to get rest. There's a whole chapter on sleep, for example, and another chapter on rest. So how important that is for the brain, the body, to start to rebalance.
Right. So it's so interesting that we mentioned in the book a book that was written by a physician. It was called the Causes of Increased Nervousness in Americans. The Causes of Increased Nervousness in Americans. And it was written in 1881.
So that was before COVID came up.
Well, But the idea, the hypothesized causes of what this doctor perceived to be this in his career, perceived that the increasingly nervous people were things like Western Union and the railroad and the stop the pocket watch, things that made life go faster.
Oh my gosh.
Or made them more attentive to small increments of time. And you think about now, and now, so things that threw out that balance of rest and activity. And now, with life proceeding at the pace of light, where that the average teenagers now who need 9 1/4 hours of sleep not to feel tired, as seniors in high school they get 6 or 6.5, which is just profoundly sleep deprivation, leading to profound impairment. And what we want is we want kids, we want a way of developing kids for to develop themselves that's sustainable. And it's just some of the reasons that kids don't graduate in college anymore is that high school, 4 years of high school is so stressful, they can't do another 4 years. So that colleges report their graduation rates now in 6 years. And so we want kids to develop a sustainable way of developing themselves that has a reasonable balance of rest and activity.
Yeah, how important is that? Boy, I was just thinking, this doctor, what was it, 1881? What would he be doing? What would he do if he was here today? What do you think about the what we're doing now?
Well, there's an ad for Verizon or something a couple years ago, and it was these two teenage girls were talking, and one says, "That's so 40 seconds ago." if you're in that, if that really is your kind of mind, your perception of time and life, that it's pretty stressful. And we know that technology makes life go faster and it makes it more stressful, even though it makes individual things easier. But by making them easier, we do more of them. So we actually end up working more. And so this is one of the great challenges that kids have now, and certainly in COVID, you know, with this need to be engaged with technology constantly.
Yeah.
And it's so hard for them to turn off their phones. And we have this chapter that you mentioned on sleep, that we focus really on how crucial sleep is for developing the self-regulation, the sense of control. And then we have a chapter called Radical Downtime. And sleep is one of the aspects of radical downtime. The other two are the daydreaming we talked about earlier and meditation. And so those three things, idea of radical downtime, it's just that, you know, maybe 50 years ago or 40 years ago, you know, people say, well, I relax by listening to Led Zeppelin, you know, or my downtime is playing golf or something. Well, these days, life is so fast-paced and so stressful that we're arguing we need more radical downtime, meaning eyes closed, doing nothing, you know. But actually, what you're doing is restoring your brain and your body. And
How important is that? What is your take on? Because this is an issue I'm sure most parents will want to ask you is, what is your take on the technology today and the social media and the time online regarding control? Because it's a little, to me, I got the point that it's a little bit of a delicate balance. You still need guidelines, but you can't squeeze. Otherwise, there'll be a reaction that's not welcome either. So what, yeah, what is your take on what's happening now and how prevalent that is? Because I've seen it in my own family with the younger generation. It's almost like the phone is attached to their hand, and I don't know what their hand looks like anymore.
Well, within the last couple of years, 200 psychologists petitioned the American Psychological Association, asking them to censure psychologists who are working with technology companies in Silicon Valley that are knowingly, intentionally creating products that are as addictive as possible. So the whole model of the internet is, I want to grab your attention, hold it as long as possible, and then sell it to advertise it.
Yeah.
And so, and kids of course don't know. Kids don't know that everything that they do, whether it's video games or social media, everything is designed to make it extremely hard to stop.
Oh, wow.
And so, I mean, the research on the effects of technology on kids, it's mixed in the sense that because the brain develops according to how it's used, you know, kids who play these first-person shooter video games, they get better at the cognitive skills that are required by these games, and certain aspects of visual attention, shifting the focus of your attention very rapidly, and so it's not all that, you know, that things are going to hell in a handbasket or this is so we're turning these kids into devils. Because there's an advantage, obviously. Thank God for Zoom. You know, during COVID, stay connected. But it is a matter of really of helping kids develop the ability to regulate the use of that technology, yeah, so that it serves them instead of vice versa. And so our approach is that the kids under age 4 or 5, there's no earthly reason why they should have any technology at all. There's thousands of studies that have demonstrated that play, that spontaneous, self-driven, kind of self-directed play in children is hugely beneficial. There's not a single study that suggests that kids benefit from technology when they're like preschool age. And so the first thing is that we should forestall the use of limit, great, hugely limit technology with young children. And as they get older, we start to introduce it. We want to know more about it than they do so that we can help them work out kind of healthy limits and healthy, when's the best time to play and when's the best time to get your work done, this thing. But as they get older, our focus wants to be, how do we help kids develop the ability to regulate the use of technology? Because you don't want to send a kid off to college who you've been shutting off the internet every night at 10 o'clock. They'll play all night at college. I mean, you want kids to wrestle with the same thing we all have to wrestle with. It's not that it can be addicting. It's so engaging. It's so hard to turn off. It's so alluring when you know that you hear that little beep and it could be some good news, something really, really fun. And So I think that we appreciate it, and we think that part of what we need to do, and certainly many parents have the idea that get off that stupid game you're playing. We want parents to empathize with kids and try to understand, what is it that's so engaging? Let me understand better what you love about this. Because when we show empathy and we connect with kids in that way, and we treat them respectfully, it's easier for us to guide them in working out ways to set limits and develop healthy use.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And while you were talking, I was thinking there's another part of the book where you give parents ways that they can help build confidence in their children, such as modeling and listening. And you mentioned that expressing empathy, that's an important thing. But one of the things that jumped out at me that I completely understand is the word non-anxious presence.
Mm-hmm.
And my experience teaching TM to adults, mostly parents, is they begin to notice that they're more patient with their children. I hear that a lot. And and they want to know, well, is it related? Yeah, it's absolutely related, because you're giving your physiology an opportunity to remove stress, which could be an impulse that you're functioning from. And it's also giving you that quiet within so you can handle things better on the outside. So as well as helping our children to experience that more evenness as they walk through life, the parents really want to do that too.
Well, yeah, there's a chapter in our book, Kathy, called a non-anxious presence. And I didn't make up, I wish I did, but I didn't make up this phrase. It was made up by Edwin Friedman, who was a rabbi and a family therapist and a consultant who was an expert on systems and how systems work. And what he concluded was that systems ranging from families to corporations, they work better if the people in charge are not highly anxious and emotionally reactive. And you think about it, I mean, it's much easier to calm a baby, a crying baby, if you stay calm. Or if you got a 3-year-old who's having a meltdown, it's much easier to deal with it if you can stay calm. Or you got a 15-year-old who comes home and is really upset because he just flunked a test. It's much easier to be supportive and to really help them figure out what's wrong, what to do next, if you don't fly off the handle. And you can practice empathy by stay calm. And so I'm not sure that there's ever a time where if we're having a tough time where we don't benefit from people who are warm and responsive. And so it's not something we typically think of as a goal for us as parents. But Ned and I think as we study this research on stress and the sense of control, we think this is one of the most important things we can do. Mm. And certainly I've known many families over the years where the parents meditate. If the parent snaps at the kid said, "Did you miss your morning meditation?"
Yeah, they probably did.
There's this kid a few years ago with autism, a 17-year-old with autism who learned TM with his mom. And his mother was pretty influential and got reporters to listen to the story about how transforming it was for this kid with autism to learn to meditate. And the kid was asked by the reporter, "So what does it do for you?" He says, It calms the mom. I'm sorry. "It calms the mind and it calms the mom."
Well, that's true. But well, yeah, that's so important because we don't always think how much influence we have on our kids. And you mentioned that stress is contagious.
Yeah.
So, you know, and that makes sense when you think about it. If somebody's upset, you're likely to get pulled into that whirlpool too.
Completely. And there's all kinds of research that if a mom is in the same room as an infant, and the mom is giving a stressful task to do, the infant's stress hormones, the cortisol level in the infant's bloodstream, go up as the mom does this stressful task, and it's worse if the mom is touching the kid. You know
Stress
truly is contagious, and there's a lot of mechanisms for that neurological mechanism. But it really, and so is calm. That's the beautiful thing, that calm is contagious as well. What one of the great psychologists in the world is Michael Meany, who one of his most famous studies, he separated rat pups from their mother at birth for the first 2 weeks of life. He separated them from 15 minutes a day from their mother, and then returned them to the mother. And it was extremely stressful for the rats to be separated. Then the mother would lick them and groom them and restore them, basically. And these rats, who had this experience of being stressed for a short period, then restored, became what they called California laid-back rats, almost impossible to stress. And so what he did then is he had a colony of what they call high-licking and grooming rat mothers, which were basically calm. Rat mothers, and when they're the more calm they are, the more licking and grooming they do if they're young.
Wow.
And a group of low licking and grooming that are more anxious or easily stressed. And what he did is he fostered pups from the low licking grooming to the high licking and grooming, and those rats also became California laid back rats, even though they're genetically programmed to be anxious.
Wow!
And so there's so much. It's not to say that if our kids have anxiety, that's our fault at all. It's not at all. It's just to say that one of the ways that we can help, one of the ways we can support healthy development, is to manage our own stress. And one of the points we make in the book, Kathy, is simply that if our kids are having a tough time, most of our work is on ourselves.
Yeah.
It's not trying to change the kid. Certainly we want to support the kid or get help for the kid if we need it. But it's managing our own fear. Managing our own anxiety, managing our own guilt or anger, whatever it is, but to be truly helpful, that's what our kids benefit from most.
Well, it's so important to hear these things because we come from a culture and a society that really didn't emphasize that. I mean, we naturally know to nurture the child and to care for them and all that. But just like, to me, the way I think of it is like your chapter on sleep. For me personally, I'm becoming more aware of how important sleep is and what happens during sleep, like all the toxins removing and the amyloid from the brain has a chance to move out. You know, it's so important that if you stunt that in any way, it's going to have a side effect. The same thing is true is how we treat people. It's a subtler thing, how we treat people, maybe, but it has an impact on them. And if you're loving and nurturing and you're handling something that may be uncomfortable, but from a platform of more evenness, it seems to me that the backlash is going to be less, and whatever it is, you can handle it better. So I felt, reading your book, that it wasn't just for the self-driven child. It was for the adult, too, because I found that a lot of the principles would be valuable in every relationship. Like, don't control everything. Don't feel like you have to change that person to be happy. Look inward and find that peacefulness within yourself and be more accepting. And again, it doesn't mean that there aren't boundaries that you create, but at the same time, don't go overboard. Like, I use the analogy of, you know, don't put the foot down on the gas pedal all the way to the floor.
Right, and we're working on a second. We're just finishing a second book, and one of the main points of the second book is that you really can't change somebody else. And so often, so much of what we do, you know, I told them 1,000 times, kind of thing, is we try to change kids in ways that really don't help and just create friction between us and our kids. And one of the major points that we make in the book is that we suggest that parents, especially as the kids get to be school age and older, is to think about themselves more as consultants to the kids rather than the kid's boss or manager or taskmaster or homework police or something. And it's a really pretty useful metaphor to think about that we want kids to that one of the most important things I think, well, I think the best message you can give a teenager, if you're a parent, besides I love you or I'm crazy about you, is I have confidence in your ability to make decisions about your own life and to learn from your mistakes. And I want you to have tons of experience making your own decisions and running your own life before I send you off to college. And so it's just taking this respectful kind of attitude, recognizing that we don't know exactly always what's best in the kid's best interest. And we want kids to practice paying attention to what's important to me, what I think is what do I want. And we want kids to practice making decisions, and we want to support them. And we certainly don't. We if kids' decisions are crazy, we say no, that's not going to work. But as much as we can, we just recognize that we can't make our kids be a certain way. We can't make them want what they don't want. We can't make them not want what they want. And so once you recognize that we can't make them do anything. We can't make them want things. Then the power is in this consulting relationship and helping kids really understand who they are, who they want to be, and how to get there.
Yeah, that sounds nice.
Well,
that would be a nice way to grow up, wouldn't it?
Well, yeah, or it doesn't have to come from the get go. I just talking with Ned the other night, but there's a woman who that we love who has 4 kids, and I tested all 4 kids at least twice, and Ned did SAT prep for all 4 kids. And the mom is really, she's hard driving. She's kind of type A, very kind of controlling of the kids and a lot of anxiety in the family. And she read our book and she loves Ned and I, and she really trusts us. And she's okay with my younger kid, I'm going to try this. And I just tested the youngest kid who was 15. And he was a complete hot mess. I mean, he was screwing up in school. He was having a lot of anxiety, obsessive compulsive kind of stuff, not happy. Teachers didn't like him. And so she basically took a very demanding job so she wouldn't have to watch. She stopped trying to control him. And she set limits where she had to, but she never looked at his grades, never looked at his homework assignments, and just communicate confidence that he could figure it out. And earlier this year, we got an email from her saying that he was just invited to join the National Honor Society.
Wow.
And two of his teachers said he's a remarkable human being.
Oh.
And this kind of approach, it works, but it's hard. And it's hard because if we as parents stop trying to control our kid. If we take this consultative point of view, it means that we have to zip our lip at times, and we have to basically sit on our hands, which is stressful for us because we experience a low sense of control.
Well, that is all this information has been so helpful. We have a little less than 2 minutes before we have to wrap it up, but I just want to mention the name of your book again, because for the listeners who found it fascinating what we're talking about, Dr. Stixrud, his book along with Ned is The Self-Driven Child, The Science and Sense of Giving Your Kids More Control Over Their Lives. And you can get it on Amazon. That's where I got mine. And the book explains how this is very possible and also very necessary, which is what Bill and I have been talking about today. We're going through so many changes in the world, and with COVID and the extra pressure on kids, this is a very valuable tool. As I mentioned earlier in the show, the book at the end of every chapter offers parents things they can actually do. Meditation is one of those things, and this is my expertise. It just provides that deep rest. It enlivens the default mode network, and it starts to shut down the overactive amygdala. All these things have been researched. So, Bill, I'm going to let you have the last word, and we have probably about 30 seconds before we have to go to our public service announcements.
Well, Kathy, it's a pleasure talking to you. And I do think that the meditation piece is really very beneficial for kids as well as for adults. It's not easy to get kids to do it, but when they do it, they have the same benefit as adults do. All kinds of research suggests that. And so what I'm working on now is trying to get schools to have meditation periods where kids who want to meditate can meditate together, because if they're doing it together, it just makes it more likely that they'll do it.
I hope that you're successful, because it seems to be quite necessary. And I deeply appreciate you taking your time today and explaining the wonderful principles of your book. And thank you very much. And for the listeners, I will be back in December, and I wish you all deep peace and happiness. Have a wonderful day.